Okay, the midterm is a week from today, as far as that is to believe. Woo-hoo! So, we will put it in the undergraduate library. Science libraries are the old exams, both the midterm and the final. You can check out. But just to be nice, we will also post a midterm in the lab here. You can take it away to copy it, but that's all you can take it away for. So get it back as soon as you can if you can take it out. And I am going to have a review session tomorrow night, Wednesday night, from 6:30 to 8 at Eberwhite Woods. There's a sign-up sheet in the lab, so you can sign up, and there's directions how to get there. It's probably about a mile and a half away if you want to walk or ride your bike or something. It's pretty close. And we'll meet in the parking lot there at 6:30. And then Dulcie.
I'm not sure if I'm going to do it. I wanted to take a vote on, I have to change my review session for extenuating circumstances, like I can't control them. So it could either be Sunday at 5 or Monday, maybe at 4 or 5. Now, I don't like to take away a lot of the weekend time, so I wanted to ask you, would you rather have it Sunday or Monday? Fine, Sunday at 5 it is. So Bird Hill, I'll put up directions and everything.
All right, great. The topic for today's lecture is river floodplains, and what we're going to be doing is, first I want to talk about the larger picture, what it means a watershed is and what drainage basins are, and then we'll look at some specific drainage patterns, which are actually on page 95 in your course pack, and then we'll talk about the different processes that go on surrounding a river, followed by the specific landforms of the floodplain, climate of the floodplain, soils, and vegetation of the floodplain. And then if we have time, we'll look at slides of last week's lab when we went to Sharon Hallow. Okay, so the first thing is talking about this idea of a watershed and what that means. And so up here on the board, I wrote this definition. There are a variety of different definitions of watersheds or of a drainage basin, but this one seems to be pretty inclusive, saying that it's the area of land that drains to a single outlet, and it is separated from other watersheds by a divide. And you've heard, you know, of the Continental Divide. That is the largest watershed that we can think about in North America. And if water falls, if a drop of water falls to the west of the Continental Divide, it eventually makes it out to the Pacific Ocean. And then if it falls to the east of the Continental Divide, it makes it out to the Atlantic Ocean. So that's a broad scale watershed, with that divide being the Continental Divide. And I'll show a couple of pictures of the Huron watershed, and so you can see what those different flow pathways are into the watershed and what's draining. But what it amounts to is a system of channels, which is also referred to as a drainage network. And I kind of like this quote out of this article I was reading that said that this system of channels represents nature's most effective means of getting water off of the land. Okay, so it's important that we understand the processes that are going on in floodplains and understand that this is a natural process in the landscape, and that it's not good for vegetation to be sitting in all this water, and so this is just a series of networks that allows the water to get removed from the landscape. Showing the traditional watershed divide, and this picture only shows the deep groundwater flow pathways that are coming. So you can see that groundwater here is all flowing into the stream, and this is a separate watershed or a separate drainage basin. So here's the divide that separates the two right there. Now it's important to understand, though, that not only does groundwater, which is called base flow, flow into this stream and get carried away, but also there's more surface flow or runoff that's either just very, not very far beneath the surface, or runs across the top of the surface. And so those are both important elements contributing to how a particular drainage basin gets drained into the channels that are draining it. Okay, this shows a picture of the Huron watershed, and all of these other divisions are actually just sub-basins within this larger drainage basin called the Huron watershed. And with another picture showing the particular outlet. So here we have, you know, every drop of water that falls within this area gets drained out to this outlet right here. It eventually goes out to Lake Erie. So are there any questions about what a watershed is, what a drainage basin is? The way that the water flows out of a particular drainage area into the different channels that eventually get carried away, the way that water moves is really dependent on the physiography, on the bedrock of the material that's present there. And so it depends, the drainage would look differently depending on if it's extremely corrodible and erosive material versus it's very resistant to weathering and erosion. And sometimes it's very homogeneous, meaning that you have one type of bedrock over the entire area. And other times we have differential types of bedrock. Some will be extremely easily weathered and others won't be, and so you'll get different patterns that way. And that's what I want to talk about next. So if you turn to your course pack on page 95, you'll see these basic drainage patterns, these pictures. And these are just 8 different very basic drainage patterns. There's a lot of variation in the real world, and there are differences in between. Some of these can be altered, but this will show you what the basic patterns look like. The first one is dendritic. And this is actually the most common. It's found in very uniform, homogeneous bedrock areas. And so what happens is it ends up branching a lot, and it looks it's called dendritic, like tree-like. And it's characterized by, if you can see, the 1, 2, and 3. First-order channels, which are ephemeral. They don't last throughout the year. They're there when there's a lot of water to be drained. And what happens is when 2 first-order streams, tributaries, when they come together, they make a second-order stream. And it takes 2 second-order streams to come together before you get a third-order stream. And it's these higher-order streams, the second, third, even fourth-order streams, those are permanent rivers that are present in the landscape. So the first-order streams are typically only there during spring runoff. For parallel, which is the next one, you can see that these are formed, they're extremely parallel ridges formed in linear landforms. And again, this would be material that's very homogeneous, very like. The bedrock could either be sedimentary, it could be metamorphic, but it's all similar in a given area. And that varies from this trellis one, which has differential material. Oftentimes, this is formed on a slanted bed. And so you might have extremely very resistant rock located at the top of the ridges and getting drained down into valleys that are more corrodible. And so you have a difference in the rock, maybe going from metamorphic rock to sedimentary rock, which would be weathered more easily. And so you get these different gaps between the ridges forming. And you have similar size tributaries coming into another branch, and then into the main trunk. Section D shows a rectangular drainage pattern, and this one's really easy because it's all made up of these right angles. So the main drainage is a right angle, and the tributaries to those come in mostly at right angles. And this is found where it's very strongly jointed rocky terrain, and it sort of guides the water in those along those joints. And so the way that you tell that from this one, these just are broken up, they're divided, there's gaps in between the ridges. And it just looks like there's more tributaries coming into it on the trellis. Radial is when, if you think of about a volcano. It's one peak, and everything's draining down from this one point. So here's the center. Water's getting carried downward from this one point, and it ends up, goes off radially. And that varies from this annular drainage pattern, which is also found when you have a dome. However, this again occurs when there's differences in the material, differences in the weathering of the material, and the drainage path will seek out the least resistant path. And so when you have these areas that are coming in, it's because it was able to break through very easily weathered rock surfaces. And so you get this circular appearance to it. And the last two are ones that we'll talk about, that kind of a combination of the last two are what glacial drift, what the kind of drainage that glacial drift has. But the first one is multibasinal, and that's any time that you have very hummocky topography. And sometimes we have specific names for it, like when it's limestone topography, it's called karst. And what happens is it gets dissolved. The limestone gets dissolved differentially, and you get sinkholes and caves and rivers underground. But anytime you have really hummocky surface like this, and you don't necessarily know where it came from, it's also called multibasinal. And then contorted is what happens. The difference in contorted is that it's just not very specific. And it forms when there's glacial drift, it's very messy, it's not very orderly, the pattern of it's not very orderly. And so the rivers are taking whichever route that they can because the underlying rock surface, the structure, is not there. So it's just flowing around the glacial drift, and the way that it looks, it just looks deranged, torted. So glacial drift is kind of a combination of both. Multibasinal can occur. We talked about how the glaciers could depress the land and the bedrock. And depending on how the drift was laid when the glaciers were retreating, would have maybe allowed it to be multibasinal as well. So it's kind of a combination of the two. Are there any questions? Okay. Then what I want to talk about is a little bit about the processes of rivers. And understanding more about what the purpose of a river is. And so rivers are basically, they're great levelers that transport material from high in the landscape, and they wash it out to lower in the landscape. So they're moving this material from upward down to lower grounds and water basins, and then they get deposited there. And they carry a large amount of material with them. This material is called alluvium. Any material transported by a river is called alluvium. And this diagram here, the one up here, shows that there are different types of materials that the river carries. One type is this bed load, which is just located in the bottom. It moves very slowly. It kind of rolls with the river, but it's along the bottom. And those are where the coarsest materials are found. So they kind of roll and tumble along the lower surface of the river. And then you also have suspended load, which are the finer particles that get carried with the flow of water. And we talked about this before, that depending on how fast the water is moving would depend on what size of particles settle out. So those clays, which are the finest materials, they will stay suspended in that flow until it almost comes to a complete stop. And then the clays would settle out. But if the river is moving faster, it'll be able to carry larger particles. And over here, this term saltation is what is referred to when the river is moving much larger particles. And it's actually just, it's sort of a bouncing, leaps and tumbles of larger particles that occur when they get picked up by either wind or by water. So if you think about sand dunes, we'll talk about dunal formation. That's how sand dunes get formed too. It's the tumbling of these particles by saltation. And this happens either through wind or through water. Okay, and then there's two other terms that I want to talk about related to what types of materials that the river carries. And one relates to the size of the particles carried. Okay, Okay, and this, the term referring to this is called competence. How competent is the river in carrying larger particles? And so if there's a lot more of the larger particles mixed in the flow, then it has a it's said to have high competence versus low competence if there are more smaller particles. And then also it relates to the number of particles that are carried. This term is capacity. So if the river has the ability to carry a very large quantity of material, then it has a high capacity versus a low capacity if it doesn't carry very much through there. And while both of these relate to the velocity of water, this one relates more. We mentioned that before. The velocity, how fast it's going, it'll be able to, if it's flowing faster, it will be able to carry larger particles. And although this one does relate to velocity, it is much more dependent on the discharge, the volume of water that's going through a particular river. Larger volume, it'll be able to carry more particles with it. Other questions about that? Is the flow of water and what happens just as a natural process of rivers. And the natural tendency of a river, if you think of a river starting out completely straight, the natural tendency is over time, we're talking, you know, hundreds, thousands of years, but over time this river will meander. There'll be different things that block it up in one area, have to go around maybe a log or maybe a rock or something. And so what happens is it'll start to go one way. So if the river's flowing and over time it starts to go this way, it's cutting this bank. As it goes, it's taking material away from that bank. It's directly cutting into it. But there's a slower flow on the inside of the meander. And this is where material gets deposited. It's a little bit slower flowing, and so it's almost like removing material from here, but then eventually downstream it'll deposit those materials that it's removing. So we have a cut bank and the point of deposition, which is called a point bar. And that's just a natural process of rivers. And over time, you can get, not only do rivers migrate from like left to right, but they also can migrate, the bends can start to migrate south in the direction that the river's flowing. I have a different diagram to illustrate that, which is this one right here at the top. So you can see that the river's flowing, and this is a much more dynamic bend of the meander, but you can see how it shows where the original path of the river was, and that over time, from cutting away and depositing, you get these big point bar deposits, and it's cutting away from the direction that it's flowing, so the river, it's migrating that way, but also here it was, and it starts to migrate away from where it was originally, and it migrates in the direction of the flow. So you have two different modes of migration of a river, and it's due to this meandering motion. Okay, so this flow that you see in a river, this is just, you know, rivers are flowing. That's a normal, that's a continuous process that occurs daily, yearly, every century. But then we have this other process that occurs on river floodplains, why they're called floodplains, and that's flooding. And this, although it's a regular process, it is infrequent. So, and we can have different sizes of floods, very major ones that are called 100-year floods, that are typically said, well, once a century you'll get a large flood on this border versus smaller floods. And what happens when there's a flood is that here's normal before the flood. The flood stage water, okay, so the water has risen onto the banks adjacent to the flowing channel. And you get these different deposits right adjacent to it. So during a flood, the thick, coarse materials will be deposited right here, right adjacent to this channel. And then as water still keep toppling over that, they start to flow a little bit. Their velocity slows down as they splash on top of where these coarse materials are, and some of the finer materials settle out over here on the outside of that. And so this is what's called a levee. Over time, it keeps building up by many different floods, and you know, even smaller floods keep splashing up, and you get a very thick amount of coarse material, sand and gravel is there, and finer silt and clay further out. And we'll be talking more about the other formations of the landforms of the floodplain, but that's a big one that occurs directly from that flooding effect. So two processes, just the normal flow of the river, which is very continuous, and the rivers meander over time, compared to another type, it's a regular process, but it's more infrequent. And then this diagram just shows how, if we looked at a cross-section of the river, how it would flow, and how that depends on what other obstacles are in the way. So, for example, the profile would be like this if there was a lake, because the river actually adjusts to whatever the base flow is at that local level. So, for example, if we have a lake here, whether it's a reservoir because there's a dam there, or it's just a natural lake, the river's adjusted to this level right here. And then further down, it's adjusted to the level where the ocean is. But over time, if something happened, that lake got drained, what would happen is the river level would just be adjusted to this ocean level right here, because that would be the base level of that river. So that's how, usually it's this concave upward profile, but it does get altered by some different local physiographic differences that might change over time, and therefore it would be this ocean base level. Okay, we'll let it soak in and then let me know if you have questions about it. All right. So those are a couple of the processes. And now I want to talk about the other features that we have. And this is in your course pack on page 96. So we're going to look at these different features that are formed within the floodplain, and then we'll look at a cross-section so that you can see what we'll be walking on over today when we get out on the actual floodplain. Okay, so the first one, we already sort of talked about the point bar. And these, again, are formed on the inside of these meanders, cut bank opposite on the outside where the river is cutting. I colored in blue the one side, the levee. Okay, we already talked about the levee. And then we have a couple of other features. An obstacle lake is one. They actually have a really nice diagram down lower showing how this forms. And what happens, I already mentioned that we have this natural meander over time. But during a flooding event, water always seeks the shortest route. So during a flooding event, it might actually get channelized to go straight down the main channel. And it kind of leaves this other channel that's out of the way. It kind of leaves it stagnant. And over time, as water's just kind of sitting there, pools up, there's very fine clays and silts that get deposited right there adjacent to the main channel. And it actually cuts this obstacle lake off from the main channel. So you have just this other, now it looks like a U shape like that. Okay, so that's the obstacle lake. And you can see up here, showing the Axpo Lake and how there's that clay club, which is blocking it off from the main channel. Meander scrolls are evidence of where the channel used to be. And so you can tell that the channel was migrating from over here, over, and finally you can see here's meander scrolls in there. But then once the meander got cut off, formed the Axpo Lake, you can still see where it was. And now it'll probably migrate in a different, it'll keep migrating this way, but further south, compared to where the Axpo Lake was before. Swales are areas in between these meander scrolls where very silty materials are pounded up in between there. Okay, it's because water was left to settle there, very fine particles settled out. And then sloughs are over here and up higher, you can see that those are areas that are very, they're very very wet. And sometimes, depending on the flooding event, they can be sort of reconducted and they can have active drainage ways through there. But for the most part, there's a lot of just organic matter deposited back there. And just they're wet areas where a lot of vegetation gets able to build up over time. And that's similar to the back swamp. Back swamp deposits are very fine organic matter deposits, very rich deposits that there's actually, and I'll show this a little bit in the profile, but there's actually a slight decrease in the elevation going away from the main channel over towards these terraces. And because of that decrease in elevation, water is able, when water gets splashed over there during a flood event, water remains there, and then water returns back to the channel or seeps down, but it stays ponded up in those back swamps. And it's very easy to identify when we've seen a really great back swamp today. The active floodplain, you can see the line up at the top, the active floodplain is called usually the first bottom in between the levee and the other terraces. We have the first bottom, not including, that's called the first bottom back swamp. So it's a back swamp located on the first bottom. So this whole area would be the first bottom. And then up from the first bottom, that's the active floodplain, that's the one that's flooding currently. And up from there we have different terraces. You can have second bottom, third bottom, those are all different terraces. And second bottom can flood sometimes. Currently, the third bottom rarely ever floods. Although we'll talk a little bit about how human disturbances in the landscape are starting to alter that a little bit. But eventually what will happen is the second bottom will no longer, it will be replaced, it will become the third bottom. If this channel gets lower, over time there's incision and the channel gets smaller and smaller and smaller. And so what will happen is that the first bottom will become the second bottom, and then you'll get a new first bottom that will occur there. So it's a constantly changing process. Are there any questions? And before we look at a cross-section of this, I have this diagram which shows how humans are kind of starting to alter these areas. And flooding is a natural disturbance in a floodplain. And what happens, as I said before, is the way that the landscape gets rid of excess water. And it really depends on the type of material you have, if it's impervious or pervious. And so because we're doing things like agriculture, housing, people want to live adjacent to the river. They don't want their homes to be flooded. And so we have channelization of streams, also dams built for power. So we have problems, there are many disturbances to the floodplain, and we're altering the landforms and changing the flooding regime. And so what happens is, in an effort to decrease flooding, because people don't want their homes to be affected or agriculture to be affected, there are fewer floods, but these floods are more devastating. And one of the best ways to understand this is to understand the trade-off between having surface water runoff and groundwater filtration and it being discharged that way. So if you look at that top figure where we have a forest, it shows that 80 to 100% of the water that comes in is going into the groundwater. And only 10 to 20% is going over into the channel. And that's because there's vegetation there. The vegetation kind of slows down water if there's a really large rainstorm. And it gets a chance to seep back down into the water because it's very pervious. But still, about 10 to 20% will drain into the channels over land. If it's cultivated, you have only about 40 to 50% actually getting drained down. 50 to 60% is making it to the channel. So we still have some vegetation that might kind of slow the pathways down and it's still pervious, but not nearly the amount to block it like canopy vegetation would. residential areas where we have a lot of sidewalks, but we have lawns, so 50 to 60% is going to make it down, 40 to 50% is going to go off into the channel. And if you look at urban cities, 0 to 10% actually gets down into the groundwater to drain. It's all concrete, so 90 to 100% actually gets drained into the channel. And so in altering the land, I mean, it's important, it's looking at the land use around a particular area and how we've altered these river channels, and it's important for, that's why it's important for us to understand the processes that go on there. Because to be sustainable with the environment, to have agriculture in residential areas, but to understand that flooding is a natural process and this is how water is transported away and that's how we get rid of it. And to alter that as much as we have has really damaged the areas around us, the floodplain landforms. So it's important for us to try and mimic natural, the way that natural floodplains would work. And so that's what we're talking about today. Are there any questions about this? Here's a picture showing showing the effects of flooding in a residential area. You can see the fires and devastation. Material and they're very infrequently flooded. However, because of these increased human disturbances and we have less frequency of flooding, but they're more disastrous, we are tending to see nowadays that these third bottoms are getting flooded where they would have never gotten flooded in a natural floodplain situation. There's another diagram, we'll talk about that more in a minute, but there's a diagram showing a cross-section of this in your course pack, also, on page 97. Okay. So, next thing is to talk a little bit about how the climate is different in these floodplain areas and how that affects the vegetation growth. To to grow there because of this difference in climate. And so on the floodplains that are located within the lake plain, the hardiness zone mimics that of one just further to the south. So we see species that are growing there, like redbud and Kentucky coffee tree, other species that are very much typical of the south, but they're naturally growing there because of a difference. And this relates to the vegetation, and it's important to understand, we want to look at climate and how the physiography in the floodplain is different and how that affects the vegetation, but it's important to understand something that triggers the vegetation to flush out, and what that is heat sump. Okay, and so heat sump is just the accumulation of heat that allows plants to flush out. And plants will flush out depending on once they reach a certain threshold of this accumulated heat. And what this means is that metabolically, plants will be active if they accumulate so many hours above either 5 degrees Celsius or 40 degrees Fahrenheit. Okay? Okay, so the heat sum is accumulated heat over a certain threshold. And if you look at, for example, a mean temperature, if plants are experiencing a mean temperature of 60 degrees for 5 hours on a particular day, then 60 degrees Fahrenheit, that's 20 degrees Fahrenheit over 40 degrees. Okay, so they have to at least reach 40 degrees to become metabolically active. And this is 20 degrees Fahrenheit over that for 5 hours. So you multiply 20 degrees Fahrenheit greater than 40 times 5 hours, which is 100 degree hours. And different plants have different degree hour requirements before they will flush out. But it's important to understand that that is what triggers flushing in the spring. Is that confusing? Are there questions about that? Okay.
Yes. Why did you subtract the 40 from the 60? Is that the 40 is like the threshold?
40 is a threshold where plants won't really be they won't be metabolically active until it's 40 degrees Fahrenheit. And then once it kind of starts getting warmer, then it's like, well, it can't just be, you know, a really nice day in February for plants to flush out, but they have to accumulate so much heat over a particular, you know, time period. So then they know that, well, it's safe enough in this region that I'm not going to be susceptible to late spring frost. I'm putting human vocabulary on these plants. But basically, they're adapted to the environment where they grow, and so they know that if they can reach so many heat hours, that depending in this climate, that's when they'll be able to flush out with very low risk of getting frosted out. So yeah, it has to be above 40 degrees Fahrenheit, and then they accumulate these hours over time. So one day they might have, you know, 60 degrees for 5 hours. Another day it might only be 50 degrees for 5 or 10 hours or something. So that'd only be 10 degrees above the threshold, and you multiply 10 degrees times however many hours that were. And so then that would be added to the 100 degree hours from before. Okay? Does that make sense? Yeah.
And then if it gets cold, I guess looking at the heat sum, they're accumulating, but then if it gets cold, does it subtract from that, or does it just stick?
It just stays. They got it, you know, and so that's why a couple weeks might go by and they're like, oh, good thing we did flush out. So, it just stays as part of them, and they have to reach so many degree hours, and I think it's probably, you know, in a very safe zone, the number of hours that they are required to reach is high enough such that it typically won't occur unless it's springtime. It's important to understand the heat sum and how that relates to seasonal differences and how the physiography affects that in the river floodplain. So this top diagram shows, here's the sun in early April, not a lot of direct sunlight right into the bottom land, right into the channel. You know, direct sun is hitting over here. And so the upland species are receiving 6 hours at 50 degrees. Okay, 50 degrees is 10 degrees above that threshold. So on a particular, you know, given day in April, they might start to accumulate 60 degree hours on a particular day. If you compare that to the bottom land species, though, right adjacent to the river, they're at 5 hours only at 47 degrees. So it's cooler down there, 7 degrees above the threshold. So 5 hours times 7 degrees, 35 degree hours. So in early April, those plants that are right adjacent to the river aren't accumulating as much heat as those plants that are upland, where they're getting the direct sunlight. Then if we compare this to May, so what happens is these upland species will flush out sooner than the species that are present in the bottom land, but those upland species might be more susceptible if there is a late spring frost. So these species down here are kind of buffered by a risk of a late spring frost because they don't flush out as soon. Now if we look here in May, when more overhead direct sunlight, the upland species averaging 50 degrees for 13 hours, so 13 times 10 degrees above that threshold, that's 130 degree hours. If you compare that to the bottom land, where now we have direct sunlight, but we also have what's called re-radiation, because of the physiography and because of these terraces, they actually the sun is able to re-radiate off of these terraces. And so 12 hours at 55 degrees Fahrenheit, that's 170 degree hours. So now they're receiving more. And this is something that's very advantageous to plants, because early in the spring, they're not going to flush out as soon, but later into the fall, these plants will actually stay active. It'll stay warm down there, and they'll be able to be really active much longer. Yeah.
What about like cold air flowing down into the valley? Does that affect them at all?
Well, it does, but the difference is that when you're adjacent to a river, so the channel's really open, it's not windy down there, and cold air is able to be, you know, breezed out of there. And also, because we're adjacent to water, it's more humid, and there are site conditions that during the day it's not as hot because you're adjacent to the water. And there's cool air that stays adjacent to above, cool air masses above the water, stays adjacent there. But then over the day, the water takes a long time to warm up, but eventually it does, and at night, it's actually warmer air masses over that water. Okay, so it's moderated in that sense too. Not only is it a seasonally moderated, but daily, the days aren't as hot and the nights aren't as cold. So it's sort of a double whammy that plants this is great climatically for the plants down in this bottom land. Are there other questions about that? Does everybody understand the concept of accumulated heat for flushing out? Do you have a question about? Okay, so that is just looking at the climate, and because of this, we have a lot of different microclimates located in the river floodplain. Looking at that profile, you notice it's very much, there's a lot of ups and downs in there. So we have little microclimate similar to what we saw in the lake plain, but even more on a larger scale. Okay, so that's looking at the climate. Next, I want to talk about the soils that are present in the floodplain, but we haven't really talked about soils very much in this class as of yet. And I had you read pages 90 and 91 in your course pack for today. So I'm going to start, we'll give a brief talk about that page and then talk about how that relates to the soils that are present in the river floodplain. So, looking at this, we have this over here, people have probably seen or talked about before, the horizons of a soil, or this is also called the soil profile. And this occurs because there's downward movement of water through the substrate, okay, through the parent material. And one thing I think that is confusing is that people tend to think that these layers are getting added to the top of the parent material that was there. So if you think about after the glacier was left and there was an outwash plane or something. Well, whatever that outwash plane, this down here is called parent material. But this whole thing at one point was the parent material. It's all the mineral, what's now called the mineral horizons. And it's not that these horizons are getting added on top, it's because of this downward movement of water through the parent material. It actually brings different things. It chemically alters, can chemically weather the soil, and it can add, if the vegetation is there, it can add organic material, humus, and it can push these materials through there. So it's a downward movement and different processes that we'll talk about. And the only thing that gets added is up at the top. These organic layers are literally from the litter of vegetation. But you have, there are soil profile, there's soil profile development even if vegetation wasn't there. When the glaciers left, there's chemical weathering, there's acid present naturally in rainwater, and as this percolates through what that parent material was, it starts to alter it and creates these different horizons. So, up on top we have the organic horizons, which are OI, OE, OA, and they're differentiated based on their amount of decomposition. So OI is very much, you can see it, it's litter, you can almost, you can usually identify what it is. OEs, you can't really identify it, but it's kind of gritty. And OA is extremely decomposed matter that's oftentimes greasy in nature. So those are the organic materials, and that is because there's material getting deposited on top. But all the rest of this was the parent material at one point, and it creates these different horizons, now called mineral horizons, based on different processes. So the A horizon, it's dark often because it has a large amount of humus coming from these organic layers. So it's discoloring the very top part of the parent material. And the big thing here is the zone of mixing. This is considered the zone of mixing. Earthworms often present in the A horizon. So stuff is being mixed from the organic material, getting mixed in, so that's why it has this dark appearance. The next one is the E horizon, which stands for eluvial. It's another way of saying it's the zone of leaching. Materials are getting leached from this area, and they're getting deposited in this B horizon, which is the zone of deposition. So it often has a reddish color or clays are accumulated there because this downward motion, this percolation through there is allowing different oxides to accumulate in this B horizon. Get leached from the E, so it's often very light colored, whitish, down into B, the zone of accumulation. And then the C horizon is just what's called the parent material. That's unaltered parent material. So it hasn't been affected by any of these other processes. That's what you would have seen all the way up to this top here. We could have seen it after the glaciers left. Okay, so that's a little bit about how the soil profiles, how they get formed. And then there's six major soil orders. And there's other ones too, but these are the major ones that we'll talk about. So entisols are ones that have very little profile development. They're new soils, so there's not much of this development yet in entisols. And you see these on dunes and also alluvial, so river floodplains. The direct river floodplain that's very new will have an entisol. The next one is an inceptisol, and that is a recent soil profile development, but it's not quite as new as an entisol. So we have very, very little accumulation in the B horizon, but we have a little bit more development up higher in the A and the E, and this is characteristic of older alluvium. So if you think of the second bottom and the third bottom, those old river terraces, those would be inceptisols. Because they're not quite as fresh as the current floodplain, but they're still, their alluvial soils haven't had that much time to develop. Another type of soil is a mollisol, and this is characterized by very, very rich, very black soil. And you see this a lot in prairie vegetation, very thick masses of grass are stuck down in that vegetation. So it has very thick A horizons, and they're very dark. And so in the prairie, in the areas that would have been prairie around here, we do have mollisols, but this is like the characteristic one over, like out in the central United States. Alfasols are very common in southeastern Michigan, and these occur where there's warm site conditions, very rapid decomposition and mixing, medium to high nutrients, and that's very typical of forest and temperate climates. So a lot of the forests around here have alfasols. And then spodosols, that's an order that's typical of northern Michigan. Often it's coniferous, forests dominated by conifers, and these have characteristically a thick OE and OA layers because there's very limited decomposition. So there's a lot of buildup of the organic layers. Those are typical spodosols. And then finally, histosols are organic soils, and they develop when there's water-saturated ecosystems such as marshes, bogs, and swamps. And that's very different. The key word here is saturated. These sites are saturated compared to flooded, and there's a difference. Saturated means stagnant water just sitting there pooling up, where flooding is that periodic process of water coming on to the floodplain and then leaving again. And so these histosols are typically more than 35% organic matter. It's just sitting stagnant in the water. And another thing about alluvial soils, these two especially, they're very rich, and oftentimes the soils will be either circumneutral or basic. They're very calcareous. And that's because of those clays that are abundant in the river floodplain in those areas where they're able to settle out. The clays hold up in the nutrient colloids. Okay, so we've talked about the climate of the river floodplain and how great that is for plants. Looking at the soils, these are very rich soils present on the first bottom and the second bottom, so the soils are really good for plants too. So this is pretty much win-win, except we have to talk about the vegetation growing there and how the only thing that they have to really worry about is the flooding, and that the vegetation that's growing there is actually has to be adapted to this flooding regime. Because everything else is there so great, so of course vegetation would want to be able to grow there. Okay, so here I've drawn, just so you can mark on that page. Page 97. You can write that first bottom entosol is very new, inceptosol, second and third bottoms is the older alluvial soil, and then alfasol is mollisol. This is pointing upward because that's what would be present in southeastern Michigan. But if we were along the river floodplain in northern Michigan, it might be a spodosol because that's what the surrounding area, the order would be like. So what's adjacent to this is all dependent on where the river is located. So this just refers to southeastern Michigan. And then the other thing I wrote on here were some of the characteristic species that are found here. And like I said, the vegetation that grows here has to be adapted to this very high level of water when there's flooding stages. And so one of the things you'll see oftentimes is buttressing the base. There's like these little knees, and we'll get to see it today, that the vegetation kind of grows on stilts because of high water levels. And also there's another disadvantage to living here is that for a lot of the time it's very low oxygen concentration because it's flooded. And so that's another thing, that a vegetation is adapted to low oxygen concentrations. And an interesting thing is that because this is a highly disturbed site, lots of water, very low oxygen, the species that are growing here are oftentimes ones that you see around town characteristically for landscaping because they can tolerate a lot of stress, they can tolerate low oxygen, so they'll plant them where there's a lot of cement because they know that they can tolerate urban stresses and some of the smog and different pollution that goes along. They're adapted now to grow in cities and low oxygen because they're growing in cement as well. So some of these species, talking about the trees that are present there, in the first bottom, there's three characteristic species that are typically seen on the first bottom. One is Ulmus americana, the other one Fraxinus pennsylvanica, and Acer saccharinum. So Acer saccharinum is the silver maple, and Fraxinus pen is the red ash, and then we have the American elm. So those are three dominant tree species of the river floodplain on the first bottom. And looking at the levee, a lot of times you'll see Platanus sycamore growing on that levee. And then we have in the slough different salix, different species of salix can grow there. And also out on the point bar, Populus, Steltoides, cottonwoods, and oftentimes it's black willow growing out on the point bars where you have that deposition in the meandering river. So those are some of the typical overstory species. In terms of the shrubs that are present there, there aren't as many shrubs present right in the floodplain because of the large amount of stress there. So sometimes right on the levee you'll see different cornices, different dogwoods. But for the most part, the shrubs don't have the ability to withstand such as large amount of flooding as the trees do. So another thing that we see here instead is a lot of vines because they don't have as much competition from shrubs. It's very open. And so we'll see things like poison ivy and riverbank grape and Virginia creeper and even different types of smilax, species of smilax, growing in the river floodplain. And there are sometimes characteristic lower understory species, but not as many shrubs. Sometimes in the back swamp you'll get, it's more open, there aren't as many trees, or they're not as dense growing back there, so buttonbush can often grow back in the back swamp. And then today what we'll be doing is looking at a lot of the herbaceous vegetation that is adapted to this. And some of the, vegetationally, a lot of the plants that are growing here are adapted to grow and vegetate, well, reproduce vegetatively. So a lot of these plants have their water dispersed, and if parts fall off from like fragmentation of the willows and also of the cottonwood, if parts fall into the water, they can get washed downstream and have the ability to grow just from that one part if there's primordia present in that stem or in that branch that fell off. And for the herbaceous species, there's a lot of bulbs and corms and underground stems, rhizomes, that have the same thing because they're dormant in the spring when it floods, so they're not really affected by that, and if they get washed away, then they'll just grow somewhere else. So you'll see those today, like the green dragon, and you'll see ginger and Matutia stupiatris. You see a lot of vegetation that's characteristic here. And at the same time, though, we have to be careful about vegetation that is characteristic of floodplains and vegetation that it's growing there, but it grows a lot of other places. So it's kind of like the lake plain. There's some things that are always found there, but a lot of things that are just growing there because it's very suitable. Anyone have any questions about that? Any of the vegetation? Okay. Then I just finally wanted to show you this diagram I put up before about the areas that we've gone in lab and where we're going. So, we talked about the first two already. Number three was down at the Glacial Lake Plain, which is off this map. And then last Thursday we went to Sharon Hollow, which is a combination of ground moraine and outwash. And then today, this shows the location of the lower Huron River floodplain, where we'll be going. And I think we even have slides to review some of the plans that we saw at Sharon Hallett. So before I start slides, does anyone have any questions?
Good for mosquitoes, then.
Good for not having as many mosquitoes. What's this? What do we have here? Good. This is good quiz review, people. It's a quiz. Actually, I should say that. Quiz is going to be in here again. We'll start around a little after 1, 105, 110. And there'll be 15 plants, just like last time. So if this was on there, what would you say? Canophilus americana, right? What's the common name?
Cancer
root. Cancer root. And the family? A family that's all wholly parasitic? Orobanchaceae, exactly.
Rattlesnake
worm, yeah. Now, how do you know it's not something else? How do you know it's not another a Botrichium onidense or Botrichium dissectum? Looks pretty dissected to me. It's not as leathery, so the touch, and then this is the key thing, the fertile front. So
is it always going to have a fertile front?
No, it won't always have a fertile front. I mean, generally, when we quiz you, we try to give you that stuff. But the feel of it is much different as well. If you, for example, if you had this in a vegetative form, no fertile part, and you had Botrichium dissectum also without any fertile part, you could tell by the difference would be much thicker. Yeah.
Are the other Botrichiums that triangle shape?
Yeah, they are, and that's a good character for. These are actually the only three Botrichiums that we're going to do, and they're all that sort of deltoid shape. Good what's the family? Ebiantaceae. And the common name? Excellent. What's this? Yeah, exactly. Those are good. So this is sensitive fern. Anacleia, very sensitive. Anacleia sensibilis. And what's the family? Anacleaceae. Yeah, so this caught it. The first frost was down, and that's why it's has its common name and species name. Ooh, is that someone's finger or someone's sort of hairy finger? This is what?
Sanguinaria.
Sanguinaria. What's the name of blood in Spanish?
Sangre.
Sangria. Lots of things associated with it. This is bloodroot, very good name. What's the family? The whole family has these sort of latexy, colored latex. Papaveraceae, right? It's the poppy family. So, you know, opium comes from the latex of the poppy, plant. So I don't know if you can get it after this. This is it. This is so great. So we're taking you back a little in time here because you don't get to see it flower because it flowers really like the first week of April almost. It's very early. And when it comes up, this is a nice little patch. I think I explained to my group that when it comes up, the leaves, even more so than this, are curled around the flower. The flower comes out in between, basically, and then It's this beautiful white flower with yellow, pretty showy yellow stamens, and it dies back to form fruit. So it is often in these nice little clumps.
Hydrophyllum?
Was it?
Hydrophyllum?
Oh, this is still blood root, sorry.
Oh,
yeah.
Blood
root, I'm sorry. Can't you tell? this is blood root.
Are those petals?
Those are petals. The white parts are petals, yeah. Very showy flower. Papaveraceae. So, and this is what it looks like when we're doing a little stroll down Sanguinary Avenue. This is the leaf, obviously. Many lobes, very distinctive in its sort of orbicular shape with those strange lobes. And then this is the fruit, and it's opened up. Those are the seeds inside. It's the bishop's cap. Yeah, Mitella diphylla. And it's called diphylla because of these two leaves on the scape of flowering stem. But it also has basal leaves, so don't forget about those. And here's a nice close-up. The petals, if you didn't get to see them.
That's great.
You know, just for kicks, this plant is also pyrogenous. This family is pyrogenous, actually, but we don't make you memorize that. So you can kind of see that it has a little cup form there, and then the petals come off. And then there's 10. So this is actually a 5-5-10-2 floral formula. I can't really see if we can focus on that one of them. So we've got 5 sepals, 5 petals, 10 stamens. We can count them up. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. And then 2 carpels. We can't see very well. 2 carpels. But we'll see the fruit on this. And you can see it opens up. So there's 2 carpels.
Oh.
Scroll corn. A little yummy piece of corn down there. Someone tried to eat one year.
Oh, gosh.
This always happens, so please resist the urge.
Yeah.
And it didn't make it to the finals, right? Lost them out of Sharon Hall. What's the scientific name? This could be in your quiz. What's the scientific name? Centrocanus, exactly. And family?
Mariaceae,
exactly. And who's the other one? This is the centricularia. And look at this, wait, prepare yourself for this next slide. Those are flowers. So don't they look like little pants? That's why it's called Dutchman's Breeches. Very cute. So you missed them for this year, but next year.
Yeah.
Okay, this is kind of a tricky one.
Feathery false solvency.
No? Although that's a good guess. It's actually, I'll give you a small hint. It's not from Sharon Hollow. It's from the lab before that. Let's just analyze what we're looking at. What is this? What are we looking at? Wait, what are these structures? What's this? The white stuff. Come on, make an educated guess here. You're all educated. It's a what?
Anatomy.
Anemone. Anemone. Hey, right family. Right family. So you're looking at showy. No. Stigma. Showy stigmas. What has showy stigmas as the sort of most showy part of the plant?
Is that hydrastis?
Nope, not hydrastis. This is very cruel. Okay. It's the lictrum. Thrillictrum diatom. It's unisexual. And this is very up close. So I have a feeling a few of you didn't get to see it this well in the field. So this is what it looks like. This is the female plant. With the showy stigmas. What's this?
White
Pachypoda. Ectiopachypoda, and it's, which family is it in?
Ranunculaceae.
It's called white mane mary. May have told you that another common name is doll's eye. There's the eye of the doll's eye. It's got a white berry with a black dot. It's a little creepy sometimes. But I'll tell you what, you know, does anyone know what pachypoda means?
Sounds like pachyderm.
Sounds like what?
I always think elephant when I say it.
Oh, yes. Well, actually, it's the same. It's named the similar. I think pachy means thick, and poda means foot. And so, before I trip on this thing, there's two acteas, and we're only going to take this one: Actea pachypoda and Actea rubra. And in Actea rubra, the pedicels are really fine and delicate, and in Actea pachypoda, they're thick. So that's the thick foot part.
Mayapple.
What's the family?
Berberidaceae,
which is the same family as Leucovach, which is Colophyllum phalaenteroides. Nice. What's it? So we have, this is.
Podophyllum peltatum.
Yes, exactly. Podophyllum peltatum. Is that? Downy Solomon seal. Yep. Scientific name? Pubescens. Yep. League name pubescens and Liliaceae. Ooh, a trip plant. Take a close look at this. You'll be seeing it sometime like this in this form. This is tricky. I'm not going to tell them. What's going on with the stamens? Just, you know, observationally. It's not wild geranium.
Is it the hairy sweet sisley?
No, it's not hairy sweet sisley.
Huh?
Okay, what if I show you this next?
Large
western, no? Okay, here's a quick hand app, but you gotta look at it fast. Yes, one more time. Okay, ready?
Oh, the great water lily.
Great water lily. Exactly. Exactly. What's the scientific name?
Hydrophyllum appendiculatum.
Hydrophyllum appendiculatum. Exactly. And it's the Hydrophyllaceae. So. It's really important on these plants as they get bigger. I know, exactly. As they get bigger, the leaves lose those water spots. They don't have the same. So you always have to look basal and become familiar with this sort of oddly, it's almost like a maple, like a sloppy maple-shaped leaf, very pubescent. But make sure you look at the base. But you have to watch the leaves. Sure. This one? Or the only four?
On the
stamens are longer
than the
petals. Yes. Exerted stamens. The other thing is, too, drain leaves more. Yeah. Okay. So, quiz at 110.
And you are ready to go.